Welcome to Archetypes and the Planets, where Jenny Montgomery and I, Bea Gonzalez, invite you to think metaphorically as we explore how we have collectively translated the map of the sky into our mythologies, religious systems, and personal psychology.
Hi, Bea.
Oh, hey, Jenny, how are you doing?
I'm well. It's the middle of the eclipse week, and yeah, it's just that there's been a lot of potent stuff happening.
Indeed, over here as well. What did you want to talk about today? What's on your mind?
Well, I'm excited to chat with you about the subject of trauma, specifically as Donald Kalshed put it forward in his book, Trauma and the Soul: A
Yes.
Psycho-Spiritual Approach to Human Development and Its Interruption. And you read this book a number of years ago. This was published in 2013.
I think the original might have even been published in the late 90s. I may be wrong about that, and then reissued maybe in 2013. It's been
Yeah, so
around a while.
in 1996, he published his first book, The Inner World of Trauma.
Right,
And
okay.
this book was kind of a revisioning of some of his views about trauma based on his experiences with his patients.
Right,
And
right.
when I came across this book, it was just this year. I think it opened up. It was almost like my vision of trauma and how it affects not just the brain. And we've learned a lot in recent years about trauma and neurological dysregulation or nervous system dysregulation. We've talked about trauma in terms of the effect on the body. I think there's much more somatic understanding of trauma, and that's the way to go oftentimes in trauma treatment. But I had not read that much about trauma as a spiritual phenomenon.
Right.
And what really blew me away about this book, Bea, was when I got to chapter 8. And he applies this understanding to Jung's own biography and to the Jung's creation of his psychological approach as his own journey, almost like his own hero's journey through the landscape of trauma and terror and dissociation and fracturing of the psyche into multiple parts. And so Jung had some significant traumas in his early life, which some of them I knew about from memories, dreams, and reflections. He didn't have a great relationship with his father. And this is, we're also going to look a bit at Jung's astrology chart as we have
Right.
this conversation.
Yes.
Yeah, so there's some difficult stuff in Jung's chart around the father and some oppression that comes from the planet Saturn in the first house opposite to his son and all of his some other things that are placed in the seventh. And so there's that, but there's also this very difficult sort of complicated pr maternal presence
Oh,
with
yes.
So from what I understand, and I don't think we have any sense of, I don't, of the ultimate causes of this, but that his mother had mental health issues and that she could be very present during the day and could be with the family, but that at night she was haunted and that there would be sounds and noises coming from her room and that Jung even saw an apparition of a headless figure emerging from the room, or a figure with its head disconnected and moving ahead of the body. So quite terrifying. And then at age three, I think there was a great crisis in the marriage. That's right.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
That's my memory, yes.
Yeah. And then also she spent time that year institutionalized. So when, and this is, so I'm curious about Kalshed's approach, but I'm also really curious. I wish that I could sit in the living room with Donald Kalshed and talk astrology, because I
Yes.
feel that this, it does help us to be able to recognize, and I see this with astrology clients, and we know this from our own lives, is that when we see a resonant image, and this is actually a quote from the book, This is the way it is with the human soul. It seems to need a resonant image from the human or non-human environment if it is to come forward, something it recognizes. And that recognition that we find in analysis or that we find in sort of deeper astrology is something that Jung recognized and that he practiced with his patients
Right.
in the later.
It's interesting you should, on a little bit of an aside, I just was revisiting a couple of books beyond the. I just realized I think I read The Inner World of Trauma, not Trauma and Beyond, by the way. Because when you said that, I thought, oh, this is the follow-up book. I actually read the first one where he also speaks about Jung quite a bit, but in a different way. But in revisiting the many Jungs that exist, because one of the big problems I find with looking at Jung's work and life is how many people want to impose their version of Jung on the reader or the person looking at his work. And as you know, Liz Green, the astrologer, did two books on Jung. She had access to the actual archive, and really speaks a lot about the period. The second one, the one about the Red Book, really speaks deeply about how all these figures have. That emerged spontaneously from his active imagination exercises during the period that we're going to talk about between 1913 and 1916, but it went on beyond that, were really fine correlations in the astrological archetypes. And I was considering how people like Peter Kingsley, who wrote this monumental book, Catafalque, but in the second volume went absolutely crazy attacking all the other Jungians, and how people put other people's experiences in boxes because they don't understand. Kingsley's attack on Liz Green is insane because basically it's like, well, she doesn't know what she's talking about. I mean, she had access to the archives. It's pretty clear that Jung was very well versed in this language through the work of Alan Leo and through a personal relationship. He was corresponding with André Barbeau. I mean, there's plenty of, and his daughter, for God's sake, who's an astrologer, who I think at some point started drawing the charts for him. So I was just considering this about how you look at a life, right? And that we're apt to project our versions of what our philosophies or versions of what we want to see on that particular life. What I find useful about Cowshed's work is his incredible experience. In a clinical setting, seeing these kinds of wounds coming to light, and then being able to see how it matched Jung's own journey and how it made him, by the way, because I think one thing we all can all say about a chart is that it often tells you where you are going to have. I call it the unresolved chord, by the way, using the Tristan and Isolde idea that there is something in our lives, maybe more than one thing, which is usually a square between two planets or whatever that keeps showing up. And it's not always the same. In the opera Tristan and Isolde, the chord keeps changing but never resolving. Only
The
resolves with death.
eternal
Yeah,
yearning.
it's like this thing that's constantly pushing you to growth. And so you look at this chart in particular, and you think, my Lord, it's almost like you can see how important the ancestral piece of this is just by seeing Pluto Moon right in that fourth house, square Uranus and square widely on the other side, Saturn, right? You've got this incredibly difficult setup. And you talk about the early life. And yes, both the mother and the father were very difficult experiences in different ways. Although through the mother, I think he got that Neptune kind of connection to the imaginal realm, whatever we want to call it, you know, all these strange. He did write his thesis on, I think, a cousin who was
The
a seer, right?
seances.
Yeah, seance, yeah.
So with that moon and the fourth, so the
Yeah.
first of all, the sun and the moon are in great shape in some
Right.
ways. So the sun is in its rulership in Leo, it's in the bounds of Venus, it has there's an enormous life force there. The moon is exalted in Taurus, and this I feel I you know in that memory that he has as a 3-year-old of laying under the trees and watching the sunlight, feeling really deeply immersed in nature, that becomes a realm of numinosity and protection for him during this really difficult phase. So the sun and the moon have this ultimately like healthy potential, with the moon also in the bounds of Jupiter. There's some protection there. And just to summarize some of Calshed's theory and trauma and the soul, essentially when the child is so overwhelmed and unable to cope with he that there are almost there's that the defense both protective and persecutory sides of the protective mechanisms. And he relates some incredible anecdotes and stories about people who are undergoing horrific trauma as young people, and but they'll have a vision, near that time, that moment, or they'll be protected from going into the room where the death has taken place, almost like an angelic intercession. And then, we're also very familiar with the persecutory side of the defenses, which will persecute the inner child or the soul or the self, or try to, sort of inter the vulnerability in a place where it's unreachable and where feeling stops. And that, that this can also be turned outward, and that people who have experienced trauma may find themselves moving in a landscape of threat and being highly reactive. But he inquires so much into, the nature of these defenses, both the numinous and the protective and the dark kind of demonic, and really looks at them as going so deeply into the collective unconscious, or into something so archaic that it actually opened up my understanding of evil.
Yes, that's very true. I actually, in the inner world of trauma, he relates it also. I understood Answer to Job a lot better by what Cowshed said, that he basically explores this and explores that that's how Jung understood evil, and represented it, that there is a driving force within the psyche, right, to grow and to develop beyond where you are, but it may be experienced as the thing that scares you the most. And he has many examples there as well of creating personalities that on the outside you would think, my Lord, they're threatening. On the other hand, there is a drive in the psyche to grow, and that is actually the mechanism by which you're doing it. And so it's extremely powerful if you are working. Like, the thing about Donald Cowshed is those people he works with found a very able guide in him. Because if you are dealing with these forces internally on your own, it is extremely difficult. It is so wounding. And I think what's extraordinary about Jung is was his inner directive to resolve this in himself in some way. And you could, we'll look at the 1913 period later, but there's something that actually was driving that push, which he then was able to codify in some way for the rest of us. And so it's almost like he was living the Answer to Job story. And there's so many ways to look, of course, at his story, because he lived such a long life, and his work developed so much as he grew older too, that it's hard to know what Jung we're talking about at any given point. But there seemed to be an inner directive born of wounding, which, as you said, is totally in his chart, right? That setup is just even Saturn moon. I know it's not, the orb is quite wide, but the Saturn moon is a good marker for a mother who's inaccessible, right? I mean, you see this all the
Absolutely.
time.
And Neptune's co-presence in the fourth
Yes.
house is, that yes, there's an absence, and we're going to see that in the charts around the time he was three. Also that there's a very, very wounding absence and abandonment. So I think that Pluto moon is and Uranus, it's shocking that
Yeah,
Uranus,
it's,
it's like the tower card. It's like the world shatters, threatens to shatter, and falls apart. And I think we can also really talk about the moon as representative of that child slash soul. And
right.
this is something that's also phenomenal about Cowshed, is the identification of the wounded child with the archetype of, and in the Red Book, Jung comes across childlike figures,
Yes.
and even in the figure of a girl. So this is we see the fracturing and the def and that I think the defenses are very much there in that Saturn in the first house, and also the Aquarian ascendant, feeling different, feeling
Yes.
cut off, being made fun of by other children, having a sense of that he, his personality number one, which was almost a husk
Right.
of false presentation, and then a sense that there was something authentic,
Right.
in dialogue with that or underneath that. And but yes, the maternal experience is so powerful. But I also look into the fourth house, and as an astrologer, when you see Pluto, Moon, and Neptune in the fourth house, you're thinking, what are the family secrets?
Oh, yes,
There's
for sure.
clearly so much that we don't know about Jung's ancestry,
Right.
and there.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking of how much he talked about his relationship to Goethe and how he intimated that there was, well, there was a some sort of rumor that he was
Yes.
related to Goethe, who of course created
The
the
cousin or
most
something.
read book type thing before, which is
Yes,
the Faust, especially part two. So he's
right.
speaking about how there's some connection to, and I think he was very taken with Goethe. That was his
Oh.
the artistic genius, rightly so, yes. But yeah, I know that fourth house carries a lot of, and I think it goes beyond the parental story. It goes, you know, there it goes generations, and you look at it and you think there's so much sitting in that one spot that is spurring on. The other thing that I always think of, because I became fascinated with Marsilio Ficino. And as for those who don't know, Marsilio Ficino was the who sort of a priest who was also astrologer, who was hired by Medici, Cosimo de' Medici, to start the school in Florence, where they took all the texts and they started retranslating them, including the Corpus Hermeticum, etc. But you know,
Yeah.
Marsilio Ficino also was an Aquarius rising with Saturn in the first house, and he talked about his physical limitations, how much they had impacted his life. You know, how he had a lot of pain through his life, and that way manifested in a physical way. And I think 30 years later, is it Pico della Mirandola who's born exactly again with a Saturn in Aquarius? There is something. And also, I think with Aquarius rising, but I'm not sure about that one. But there is something about the archetype you're carrying, especially with the sun then in Leo. You know, he's
Yeah.
got this Saturn sun. So he's actually, and I don't know if you've read Ion, but for
No.
me, the thing about Ion is that's where Jung gets real about what he believes, because it was after his heart attack in the 60s. And
Wow.
that's where he talks a lot at length about the precession of the equinoxes and the astrological ages. And I've always laughed a bit because whenever this is referenced by quote unquote scholars, they bleep over this. They feel very
Yeah. Oh,
uncomfortable
yeah.
because
Right.
of course, he's dabbling in something that they don't really want to talk about. But I don't know what you think about this, just from looking at the Red Book, that Jung is basically articulating what he thinks the Aquarian age is about, both in polarity, right? Because he's got the Saturn ruling the chart in the first house in Aquarius and the Sun, which is the opposite, which you need to bring in for any age, right? In
Yeah.
Leo. So you've got both of them kind of telling you the full story. So I've always thought that the Red Book is an articulation, an unconscious, imaginal articulation of, if you're interested in the ages, and he most definitely was, of what that age is about, that you could almost read it and say, oh, this is a testament to what, and you, let's go back to what you said. Let's circle back. What it is, it's about owning the evil within, right? It's about making contact
Oh, that was
with,
so much of his message. And yeah, and Kalsha, but for me this was a breakthrough. And hearing Kalsha discuss the experiences of his patients and his own understanding of how the almost sadistic powers in the system of the psyche can turn against and begin to attack. And he likens it to an autoimmune disease that attacks healthy tissue. And he does describe it as a Faustian bargain between that is struck to protect this vulnerable soul from a persecutory devil. But the price of that bargain is that the soul is disembodied
Exactly.
and
Yes.
unrealized. And it's the language in which he discusses, and I think it's actually Winnicott's language, the descent of the child into the body, the descent of the soul, is very Platonic. It's
Yeah.
very Neoplatonic, yeah,
Yes,
and that
absolutely.
we actually don't get to come all the way in. And of course, that is a story about the descent of the soul through the planetary spheres.
Planetary
That
spheres,
is
yes.
how we embody. That's how we
Right.
become, yeah, a whole person. So yeah, Jung's chart here is it's afflicted, but it's also dignified.
Oh, yeah.
He, you know, and the Leo, all of that Leo. In the seventh house, a seventh house sun of any sign is going to need the help of partners and be surrounded by others that are going to help them creatively sort of dialogue and relate their way into their true self. And it's so I just want to point out quickly that he has Vesta, Pallas Athena, Juno, and Ceres, all of the four main asteroid goddesses written about by Dimitri Georges in his seventh house. And Lilith, exactly on the midheaven. So it's the presence of all of the women in his life, the role of his wife Emma in creating a container for him to do his work. He has Venus conjunct Mercury, multiple women. This is a little bit of a polygamous signature there in the sixth house of healing. And so, yeah, I just and often you see Vesta near the personal planets of men who have a lot of daughters.
And a lot of his analysands were women. In fact, the majority of his analysands were women. But I would also add that I think he was entrusted, it was Marie-Louise von France who talked about that he was entrusted with bringing the grail back into society, and that the grail was the feeling function, which is often associated more with the feminine. And so when I look at all these feminine figures, I think archetypally what it's also telling us is that he understood, even though he had that, and he fought with this because that's what the Red Book is really about, how to integrate his own feminine side. What he is really, in my view, most potent, well, where he's most potent is having brought that whole feminine side in. And feminine, of course, is a difficult word, as we know, because it gets, but it's the idea of value, of valuing the feeling side, of valuing connection as opposed to separation and discernment. And so when I look at all those feminine and figures, I also think that archetypally, that this is what his genius was, to be able to say, you know, we've got this great scientific revolution. It was fantastic. And yet we have lost the connection that we need to the relationships we have, well, not only within ourselves, but to others. And that seventh house, of course, being so packed, he understood this, I think, not only from the way he lived it out, but what was missing in the world. Because the relational values don't allow you to think things. I was just reading von France on this, how absurd a question would be. And somebody posited this, somebody had asked this at a meeting, not people in my group, but they had heard this about gaming out how many people are going to survive, say, if you have a nuclear war. That's an unethical question on many levels. It's an unfeeling question because one person lost is a problem. And I think that's what he was trying to bring in, the idea that you can't speak statistically only, you have to differentiate, understand the individual story. And so for me, that is all very much aligned with his journey. And so the Mercury Venus is also really speaking, Cancer as well, is really speaking about how he understood the deeper levels of the feminine that often, which I think were banished by then. I mean, certainly in the scientific realm, it just was not going to be considered. It was statistically, everything was statistically tabulated already by then in the 1930s, I'm thinking, right?
Yeah, and you just the shape of the chart, you know, the some charts have all the planets bunched up in one place. Sometimes there's a lot of, you know, opposition going on. The chart itself really has a kind of a mandala quality. There's a lovely many trines and sextiles that create beautiful sort of a harmonious web. And that Venus and Mercury are making only harmonious aspects throughout the chart. I mean, you have to stop also and think about Leo and the myth of Parsifal that, you know, Liz Green relates Parsifal, and I know you're really interested in that story, but that Leo doesn't start out necessarily strong. Our sun sign is something we are evolving toward. And Jung felt a great sense of weakness and inferiority and not standing out. And endured a lot of shame, a lot of judgment, the great humiliation of writing a very good paper that he cared about as a schoolboy, and then being told that in front of everyone by the teacher that he had plagiarized it was this horrific, horrific
Terrible.
humiliation, which is then, you know, recapitulated in the rejection by Freud. But it takes him a long time to kind of go on that journey. Having a lot of allies, having a lot of help, many of his best ideas being worked out in conversation with women. And yeah, and then of course, that great question in the Parsifal myth that he fails to ask the sickly king, what is it that ails you? You know, this becomes the, you know, the point of his entire life. That is his question to himself and to mankind,
Do you
humankind.
think that's also encoded in that exact Venus square Neptune? Because to me, that Parsifal myth really brings in that Neptune of compassion. It's an exact square. You know, the big problem with Jung for rationalists, even people within the Jungian community, this is a constant argument, is to keep him as an empiricist and to not talk about the mystical side. But to me, Jung, that Neptune tells me the mystical side, and this is what Peter Kingsley argues in Catafalque, is actually the whole story with all the rest of it, you know, sort of as a subtext. And to me, that when you say Parsifal and asking the question, which is ultimately a question about compassion, that Neptune is coming in. It's like, I need, this is what I'm here for, to understand that this is what's most important. I would also say that Aquarius, we're talking about his wounding as a child. There is something about Saturn in the first house that I think does predispose maybe, or can manifest that way early in life, you know, that somehow, not, and especially in Aquarius, not only do you see yourself as the outsider, but you're branded as the outsider in some way, right? So there's like, no,
right.
But that's what builds the backbone, you know, Saturn and Bax. It's what builds the character, but it's painful when you're a young kid,
it's
you know?
Painful. And I think there was the sense of deficiency. You know, he says, I always knew that I was two persons. One was the son of my parents,
yes,
who went to school and was less intelligent, less attentive, less hardworking, decent and clean than many others. So that, you know, and then his personality number two was grown up, old, in fact, skeptical, mistrustful, remote. This is Saturn, all of it.
Yes, totally.
Remote from the world of men, but close to nature, the earth, the sun, the moon, the weather, living creatures, close to the night, to dreams, and to whatever God worked directly in him. I knew I was worthy of myself and that I was my true self. That's the whole spectrum of Saturn there, from
right,
that inferiority complex to the deeply rooted earthy material wisdom of the
right,
Senate.
right. I think also that Mars, which is really, you know, if you look at it, it's wildly trying the Leo planets, but not really the sun, but it's you know, they're if you're looking at it from a Hellenistic point of view, they are in conversation, in a good conversation, but it really speaks to how much his philosophizing sides. Like, to me, he is a philosopher beyond, before being a psychologist. He was really dealing with the big questions of meaning that I think psychology had abandoned by the mid 20th century, right? Which is, you know, more behaviorist. He was really looking deeply as, what are we doing here? You know, what have we come to do? And what questions, what are the right questions to ask? Which is why I love you brought up Parsifal, because really it's about what questions are we asking of ourselves, of our environment, of everything, really. And so I see that being put in, although I noticed you've mentioned the besiegement here, the idea that it's Mars and Saturn besieges the ascendant widely, but it's there. So again, we talk about how his personal core, how he saw himself, had that element of, and by the way, I think this didn't only just last when he was a child, all through his life, I think he felt a bit misunderstood. Do you remember when he said, late in life, he said, the more work you do of this nature, the more alone you'll feel, which is such a Saturn and Aquarius in the first house thing to say, that you'll feel completely misunderstood or not understood, and that invariably you end up with only one person you can have a conversation with, which was in his case, I think, Marie-Louise von Franz. After his wife died, there weren't many people who understood him on the level that he wanted to be understood, I think.
That's right. That's right. And the kind of that scene of a humiliation in the classroom by the teacher, who essentially said, what you have brought is not real. It isn't real. And that, you know, that wound kind of stayed with him and was recapitulated at different times in his life. And then even in Trauma and the Soul, Kalshed goes over Winnicott's takedown of Jung and Memories, Dreams, and Reflections as the sign of a person who was schizophrenic. You know, that Jung was so deeply wounded that his personality had fractured and he'd gone crazy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kalshit says, essentially, this is the viewpoint of a person who does not see the other world, the world of the unconscious, the psyche, and the numinous.
Yeah.
It's all in that, you know, rational. And so that, that you can't, you know, he had to be so vulnerable to go forward with. And what are the things he didn't come forward about? Because he just couldn't endure anymore. Astrology, we'll never really know. The book that Jung would have written about astrology.
Yeah, it would have been so interesting. That's how I remember you mentioning it with Jen Zart, your conversation. I would have loved to have seen the book, because eventually he went to alchemy, but he always said alchemy was the younger sister to astrology. So it's basically all tied up in the same world. But the privileging of the inner world versus the outer world is, I think, what he gave us, that we don't, have acknowledged quite enough that the fact that the psyche is real, that what is produced by the psyche, and any creative writer, as you know, will tell you it's real. It's real in a different way. This is one of the things, I don't know if you encounter this problem, trying to talk to people about this subject who are, very rationalist, very sensation, that they cannot under the sticking point is this whole idea that the psyche is real, that whatever can be produced there, that is dismissive. And yet that period you went through, and by the way, it does relate to what you say about being, being accused of plagiarism. It is interesting he never published he never allowed the Red Book to be published until while he was alive. And partially I've heard that the family wanted to maintain, and the societies that were built, that were Jungian societies after he died, wanted to maintain their illusion of empiricism in a world that did not recognize something of this nature. So maybe it needed to come out when it did in 2010 or so. But the fact is, he was afraid of that coming out, or he would have published it himself. He would have made it. And that's interesting to me because post 19, I guess 44, when he had his heart attack, he did publish Answer to Job. He did publish Mysterium, which is an incredibly complicated work, and he also published the third one, which is Ion, which is really again talking about the astrological ages. And yet, this he wouldn't release. And you wonder what way. And he always said the imaginal world. He talked about Goethe, talked about Dante. What's produced as visionary art, and you would say Red Book is very visionary, is the only art that's worth having. And yet he didn't release it. Is
No,
that, do you think?
he wasn't impervious, but I think it wasn't just his ego. It was that he needed his legacy to be safe.
Right.
And but when that event happened and he was humiliated by the teacher, what he wrote about it is, my grief and rage threatened to get out of control. And then something happened that I had already observed in myself several times before. There was a sudden inner silence, as though a soundproof door had been closed on a noisy room. It was as if a mood of cool curiosity came over me, and I asked myself, what is really going on here? It was as though a breath of the great world of stars and endless space had touched me, or as if a spirit had invisibly entered the room. So this is Kalshed's numinous protective archetypal force that comes to the person in trauma. And this is what
Right.
you had so accessible to him. So even though they're spread across that signs, they're like, look at that Neptune Chiron conjunction.
Yeah.
And it's like the wound, the very, very deep wound, and yet there's something redemptive in it.
Yeah.
And all and we see the Christian, obviously, the crucifixion and the redemption is such a strong theme for Jung. And although he doesn't really get Christianity in the same way as a child, and even feels oppressed by it, and I have to mention here something that shocked me. I was not aware that Jung was a victim of sexual assault.
Yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
interesting.
And it, and the way that he wrote to Freud about it, he said it was a sexual assault as a boy by a man that I worshipped.
Yes,
And
which, yeah.
he brought this up in terms of his awkwardness about feeling that he had a religious crush on Jung, which was
Right.
ridiculous, on Freud, which was ridiculous
Yes.
and disgusting. And so when he says a man I worshipped and a religious crush, I wonder, I can only speculate whether this has something to do with that terrifying scene of a Jesuit approaching him
Right.
in his early childhood.
Right.
And there's more of a feeling tone to what he describes, but that is, that's extremely traumatic
Oh, yeah.
violation of a child's psyche. So there with the Pluto moon and the Saturn square from a masculine figure, it's, yeah, I think that there's we see the signature of that. And yet there's
Right.
this really, really deep inner self-healing force that's very much present. And the way that Kalshed writes about the mannequin, the little carved figure that Jung had forgotten, the memory of taking this figure and a little stone with it in a special box and hiding it in the attic of the family home where he could revisit it. And that being a way of protecting something sacred and inviolable in himself.
Right. It's so interesting. Liz Green notes that Saturn is very much associated with stones, right? And the one thing that Jung all throughout his life was obsessed with was stones. He was building a stone, tower, or he's, carving. He's always
Carving.
completely obsessed with this one thing. He's carrying it around. It's interesting about the wound because, of course, this was very, especially with all that fourth house activity, there was a lot of early wounding. A lot of the books written about Jung refer to him as the wounded healer. Like he is basically carrying that archetype of somebody who's so wounded that in his own attempts to heal has healed others. And I think I would say that's the way I perceive him, the way I perceive his work, that it's extremely healing from that from that perspective. So, but the stones are interesting because of how prominent a role Saturn plays in his chart.
Yes, and when we go and look at his that period of time that his mother disappeared into an institution of some kind, there was the threatening of the total rupture of the family. Looking at what happened, I'm just looking at the middle of the year when he was three in
Right.
1879. Yeah, that was very difficult. Chiron had moved exactly into conjunction with his Neptune. So it was almost like that potential that was there in the natal chart is now completely exact. The year that he turns three, Uranus squares the midheaven and lower heaven axis, and Pluto is moving towards the lower heaven. So this is an incredibly difficult time for a small child, and Chiron is now in exact square to the sun.
Right. It's like the triggering of everything that would then unfold. And actually, as you say, but well, this is where I get into that unresolved chord that keeps resounding. So when he hits that whole period with Freud, you're right. It just starts, it replays, right? It brings it to light again. And I think one of the things that reading Peter Levine or Gabor Mate or all the people or Bessel van der Kolk, who read a lot about trauma, one of the things they talk about is a trauma is a reactivation of something often that happens. So it's a it, if it didn't happen as an original wound, which had happened obviously very early on to Jung, it won't have that same impact, especially because trauma prior to the age of five, you don't articulate it, you don't yet have the words to understand. So then you've got it almost lodged in the unconscious. So then you move on. Something actually happens in the outer world, and you're not realizing that it's replaying that note. It's come back. And, if you're a very young child, you may not even remember what happened. You just know that something is happening now. So, yeah, it's everything here was, it's almost like here's the clock. Boom. This is the beginning of what would then spend a lifetime resolving or trying to resolve.
Pluto has such a connection in the chart with trauma. So, there are many kinds of traumas. Saturn can rupture, separate, create scarcity, hunger, lack of resources, or deprivation of some kind, or the dis you know the or the death or disappearance of a person that to whom we're attached. Uranus has its sudden and unexpected shocks. It's I
Yes.
associate that a lot with things that really violate what the nervous system can endure, and
Yes.
things that are often fast and unforeseen. So I wonder if his mother's breakdown may have been similar to that Uranian sensation of just this is almost like an image of the tower card,
Right.
that rocking of the vertical axis.
Right.
What falls and then what remains. And that's, the tower card, we see the part that's falling, but let's also focus on the strength of the portion of the tower that is still there and that can be built upon. So
Right.
it's sometimes very revealing to see, oh, okay, there was a fault line here all along. And then Plutonian trauma that is, to me, in my mind, very connected with the Persephone myth, or the descent of Inanna, the any part of us that is forced to go underground, that feels like it's been removed from the realm of the living. And then the whole cycle of the grief taking place and the blight up on the surface of the earth of Demeter's grief, and then Hecate's appearance to go down and to reclaim
Right.
what has been interred or abducted. So we see that a lot in here, like even the image of Pluto on the lower heaven, it does feel like a burial, but also it could be like, oh, this is when the hidden treasure is put, is hidden and it
Yes.
will be come back and discovered later.
Well, this is interesting because, of course, Pluto, who took, which, by the way, in 1930, I think, took on some of the ancient significations that Venus carried through the Inanna myth, which is very much associated. I think one of my theories is always that there's differentiations within the planetary archetypes so that other things take it on. And I just, Pluto is where you are taken into the underworld. But I think that's also the moderns really understood it. And I think in a different way, and knowing that that is also the area where the greatest potential for growth, for transformation can occur. But I think we always want to skip the Pluto part, which is really again, looking at the Inanna myth, the hanging upside down naked for 3 days on a meat hook. You can't really get away from the pain. And this is what I associate this early life with. It's just like a, and by the way, he carries it throughout his life because it's just wired in to his moon, which I also take to be the emotional center, but also a little bit of the nervous system seems to be carried as well. So it's like you're carrying this and you're trying to resolve it all the time. And I have found this with Moon Pluto people, that there is a constant being retaken or revisiting that underworld to solve the original wound in some way, which is probably you can't resolve fully, but you can certainly get to a level where you understand it. The level of understanding increases, which is, I think he, in his case, is the case.
Pluto Moon is makes an incredible researcher, therapist, detective, spy,
Yes.
anyone who works, with underground materials. But it does bring us in contact with the dragons or the hydras that we cannot defeat just by cutting their heads off. It's definitely a trying to bring the light and the consciousness
Right.
to what Pluto has entrapped.
And that it's a process, that it's not a fast moving, it's a 3 year
Slow.
transit by transit. It's slow and it can take, yeah, and it even extends beyond. But you're going to be in it for at least 3 years, whether you like it or not, as it moves and retrogrades and does its dance across. Yeah.
So I'm just looking at the primary directions in 1879. Neptune is square the ascendant by primary direction. And then in 1913, Pluto is square the ascendant by primary
Right.
direction. So those are two incredibly powerful events. I'm just going to go up here too. So we when we look at 1913, we have right around the time that Freud writes the letter in January of 1913, saying I propose that we abandon our personal relationship or whatever. I mean, that's within days of Uranus's exact opposition to Jung's sun. So that tender and vulnerable Neptune sun square is just demolished by the impact of this Uranus. Neptune is squaring Chiron. Saturn is now on that lower heaven. So
Right.
Pluto there when he was three. Now 1913, Saturn is there. It's a breakage. It's almost like the cutting off of the roots. And for a seventh house Leo sun with the father issues, this
Yeah,
is
no
so
kidding.
tremendously,
Yeah.
that he develops in dialogue with Freud. He develops, the tension and the friction with him is part of what creates him. So this breakage has to happen. And then Tony Wolf comes into the picture. This 1913, he reestablishes contact with her. Chiron is beginning to trine Venus at that Venus Mercury conjunction. And there is some way in which her ability to hold his experience as he descends into active imagination, fantasy, or some form of psychic crisis is very, it's like the positive thing that's going on here, and also some Jupiter contact with that Venus.
Right. I think the Uranus opposite the Sun period, which really starts with that letter and then actually peaks because he gets the Uranus opposition to itself by, I guess, 1916, which is when he's about the end of it, which really talks about the classic midlife crisis. He is really Dante going into, just like Dante did in midlife, I go into dark wood. But the thing that impresses me about him is he never wavered. even though he wanted so badly to have that relationship, he was ostracized from the community. He didn't care. And I think that speaks to the brilliance he had and the independence, which is a gift of Uranus, you know, being at the one hand, you get the positive and you get the negative, right? You get the square to the moon, which means that there's always going to be some issues vis-a-vis the moon issues, mother relationships, sometimes the feminine, which he tried to resolve. But it also gave him a certain amount of independence that I think is so key. Of independence of vision, he wouldn't, he wasn't going to stand for, remember that whole conversation with Freud about you must stand up for my theory and build kind of a bulwark or whatever, remember the exact
Yes, don't
words?
ever let it change.
Don't ever let it change. And he's like, no, are you kidding? And that is, I think, the gift, the hidden gift of this period, that yes, he did have the breakdown, but he wasn't going to capitulate to play the game. And that's such a Leo thing as well, right? That my vision is my vision. And I will pursue it even at the cost of my professional reputation, which happened to him, that was gone, and his professional relationships, which he valued, like you said. It's often I think people refer to Jung as Freud's disciple, which I think is so wrong. I think they had a sort of a well, you say is the best way, a conversation, an ongoing conversation where they learned from each other. But I think probably Jung was more open to learning than Freud, right? Freud had
I
his
think, you
theories.
remember when they met, he said that they sat and they spoke together for like 13 hours. I mean, it sounds just like almost manic, but he said the atmosphere in the room was that of a birth. He said everything was present, everything was there. And yeah, so, it was a tremendously generative. So again, sun in the seventh and sun Leo having to have this encounter with a father figure, but then also just the intense healing that Jung had to do around that issue. We factor in sexual assault. We factor in the fact that he acknowledged how, troublesome it was that he had a quote unquote religious crush on Freud. There are so many dimensions to why he felt such a loss. Why did this come? Why did he feel that he was almost come to the limits of losing his sanity in 1914 when he goes to give the lecture in England? And he says, I was lecturing about schizophrenia, and I felt that as soon as I finished the lecture, I was going to go mad myself. Like, here we see just the pressure on his psyche in this transit chart and over the coming years. You can see Saturn is on Pluto. Pluto is opposite progressed Mars on the midheaven. Will he survive? Like, he professionally became a pariah for a while, but it's like, the pressure on his Mercury with Chiron aspecting Mercury, Neptune, he feels like he's going crazy. So I think that the Neptune square to the Sun natally can indicate breaks with reality. And here, the entire thing is being triggered by the breakdown of the persona with Uranus on the ascendant going rogue. Now that's his business card. That's what
It's
his
going through
business
his whole
card.
first house.
I
And
let
yet, had he not done this, he would not have developed the work that he did. And in
exactly.
fact, this precipitated this descent into the unconscious, which all of his collected works is really based on the Red Book, at the end, the visions he encountered there. And if you read the Red Book archetypally, it was this really integration of that, of those figures, especially the inner figures, especially the feminine as it grows. You're seeing his relationship to that aspect of himself. And by the way, the wise man, which is Saturn, is all over the figures of the Red Book, right? From Philemon to, they're just aspects of that wise man. But it was forged in this period where it was extremely painful. And it is so classic of midlife crisis. I think a lot of people, when they think of midlife crises, they think of, oh, I'm kind of questioning my marriage, or I'm doing this. This was a total interior descent. And what I really appreciate about the Red Book, and I'm so glad it was published and we could see it, is that he is telling you, look, this midlife crisis, yes, outside the world, I was being kind of denied by my professional, colleagues, and the mentor that I had, or someone that I really valued. But really, what was going ha on was that internal struggle as he worked his way imaginally through parts of his psyche that he had to integrate. And
Yeah,
so it is such an incredible.
literally through territory. I love all the descriptions of landscape and architecture and buildings and actual places that he has to travel through on this journey. Yeah, so all those years, Uranus is transiting through the first house. It's remaking and it's breaking down. It's breaking down his, there are those parts in the Red Book where he implicates himself and for his grandiosity and his
Yes.
ambition and all of that is just being taken down to smithereens.
Well, I mean, my favorite one of my favorite parts is when he encounters the scholar's daughter, and he is embarrassed that he's created what seems to be a romance novel. And one of the reasons I think I like him is because of the utter honesty, right? Of just this is what it is, this is where I'm at, and I will have to see. And then, of course, Salome changes as he changes, the figures change, and that's the other thing I think Kalshed mentions, which I think is really important, that inner figures can change. And as the inner figures change, the outer world changes along with it, because what you've done is you've integrated those parts that before were threatening or demonic in whatever way, you can use whatever word you want, and did not allow for feeling to take place. I really, really like what he says about trauma being an assault on the feeling state, the capacity to feel, because feeling is dangerous for people who've been so traumatized, right? Because feeling to the extreme means you may fall apart. And so working with those figures, or someone like, Don Kalshed would have been a great person to work with if you're in this state for that reason. He would have understood, that they have a function, the reason they're there. And this is where I think then bringing Answer to Job into the picture is so fantastic, that this is the dialogue that's happening outside and inside, and we're just projecting. It's all part of the same story. But if you understand it that way, you understand that there's a need for both. You stop projecting the devil onto people or groups or whatever. You start understanding that there are mechanisms at work or at play internally that think they're protecting you, but really, and in a way they are, by the way, because you do feel without the proper boundaries or container, you may actually fall apart, right? So there is a function to them. This is what people find very difficult to accept, that there may be a reason they're there, but then of course you want to work with them so they don't
And the
take
whole
your life.
process is so incredibly productive. Like if Jung had not undergone these things, I don't think he would have had his big epiphany. You know, about this, the sacred dimension in human life, and that the psyche is seeking its wholeness, that it doesn't, it's not going to abandon, you will not be completely abandoned by psyche, and that the sacred dimension that comes forth to protect, you know, there is on the cover of this book, Trauma and the Soul, this lovely painting by Blake that shows the bright angel and the dark angel, you
That's
know,
it. They're
and
both.
yeah, and yeah, that suffering in the individuation process, and also the importance of the image of the child, of the divine child, and that's, you know, in this whole story of trauma, that it's important not to lose sight of the of innocence. Innocence in a divine sense, and not just like, oh, I'm a victim, I'm an innocent victim, and I'm living in a world of threat and perpetration, but that inviolable core is, it's so beautiful that there is this protective force that comes to it, even if it can be crippling, unless the cycle is totally completed.
Well, I mean, I think we can all agree that although the spirit, if you look at it astrologically, was incredible, it's like a volcano erupting on every level. Especially, I always think that a planet brings in its significations from the natal chart. So if you look at Uranus going through his first house and opposing the sun immediately, so what he thinks he is, and his own self-image is boom, right there, right? In some ways, or is even his path, everything that is that the solar light. And I'm really glad you said that you work towards your solar light, something you develop. You're not born with it. It's something that you're developing through life. He's bringing in that natal square, the Uranus moon. So it would really, really be more difficult than if you have, like, I have Uranus trine the sun. Whoopee. You're not bringing that same level of stress to, it's almost like it brings that signification. And so for him, that would be 7 years, which it really amounted to, because although I think he kept working on it till about 1932, the really big years are probably between 1913 and about 1916, and the most intense, and then everything after it was just shaping it. But it would have
Yeah.
been terrible, you know, it would have been a complete reworking and shattering. I think the word I have for Uranus is shatter, to shatter in some ways. It comes in and it's just this incredibly powerful, potent, and you have no control. And that to Saturn is an anathema, right? He's a Saturn ruled person. So it's like, whoa, wait, what's happening here?
Yes, that's part of the difficulty of that journey of Uranus through this Saturn ruled, Saturn occupied first house. And Uranus also liberates.
It
And
does.
it has something to do with authenticity. So for everybody, he's heading into this Uranus opposition here. And for everybody at the Uranus opposition point around 41, 42, I think there is a breakout. There's something in the psyche that says, hey, is my authenticity be contained in this external structure that you have spent years and years and years erecting?
And for many, you don't answer the call. He did. And that came at a great cost, because that's the thing. It comes at a cost. But imagine now that he hadn't. He would have told the line. He would have said, yes, Freud, I will protect your theory against all the attacks that are coming. We would have missed out on the whole incredible work that he developed independently.
Back to the mo to what he described after being humiliated by the teacher and told that his work was not real, where he said that it was as if a silence, the protective silence, encased him. It's almost like the alchemical container, and he became aware of all of the stars and all of the heavens. And that's that protective angel. That's the good angel, the numinous that comes to affirm life and affirm potential for the wounded child.
It reminds me of that story Kaushad tells, at least in the inner world of trauma. I don't know if he retells it, about the young child that is told to get the father, and she keeps coming back to the mother and saying, no, the angel says I can't go in, remember? And it turns out that the father has died of a massive heart attack. And who is that angel that was protecting that child and telling that to the mother? It's a moment you sort of stop and you think, okay. But yes, it's almost when I think of that moment at 3 years old where he connected to this, I do think that's a Neptune thing. That's the planet that I think he might have accessed in that moment, that's so tied to that kind of transcendental, beyond the earthly realm, where you are, well, the literal unconscious, you're just hitting it. And yes, so intuitive, which is what he was. I mean, it's such a great level of intuition,
That
angelic
Neptune
intuition.
Chiron, yeah, it's I have, with astrology clients, I sometimes hear these stories of an intensely traumatic childhood, but that nature plays an incredible role
Healing.
almost whispering to them, hey, there's something bigger here, you're going to be okay. Animals and pets or horses. Sometimes people with things in the 12th house, horses will be this like angelic figures, the role of books and artwork, or having access to fantasy. Many artists are forged through this kind of trauma.
No, I mean, I would think we can all look back. I think everybody has some area in their childhood which is extremely difficult, and we all had our different coping mechanisms. But you were so lucky if you could connect. Of course, if you look at all the Neptune in his case being in Taurus with the moon, then nature would have been a place where you would have naturally looked to for help, absolutely. So, yeah.
Beautiful.
Okay, well, we have talked a lot about this. The thing about, and I think you probably agree with this, with a life like Jung's and a chart like Jung, you could talk for 10 hours and you still would only be starting on the journey, because it is so rich. And if you look at each phase of his life, like, it would be interesting, and maybe we'll revisit this at a later talk. 1944, post 1944, Jung abandons his caution and decides to publish, much like I always say that I once ran a seminar on late life creativity, where you look at people like Giuseppe Verdi, who wrote his incredible operas after he retired, and then he came back and wrote, just the two most awesome, groundbreaking operas, Othello, based both on Shakespeare. And equally, someone like Frank Lloyd Wright, who was working really at his peak, really late in life. With Jung, it was the 70s, where you get his most intense and really powerful work beyond the Red Book. Okay, that's
We'll
a
have to come
different type of work.
Look at
So it'd be
that.
interesting to
That'll
look
be
at it to
fun.
see what happened in 1944, what was
Yeah.
going on, and what happened in the third act of life, because I think that's where you start getting the real Jung, as much as you could get him anyway. So, but for
Absolutely.
now, we will leave it at this. It's such a fascinating conversation. And I just realized after, like early on, that we read two different books by Kaufman. But by the way, he in the Inner World of Trauma, which is also a brilliant book, he does mention also Jung. He has a whole section on Jung. I think what you're describing, and I'm going to go find it right now, is the follow-up where he might have looked at it a little bit more in depth. But he definitely has it. He has a lot on Winnicott and gives a lot of really good examples. I just think Donald Kalshed is just a genius, honestly. Having reread that book and now eager to read the second one. His ability to communicate also what he has gone through. And I will leave you with this with Kaushad, which I'm really impressed. He said that he mentions in his talks and in the Inner World of Trauma that a therapist who's not willing to open up about their own lives to their patient is not going to help them. And I thought that was really super interesting.
I was just thinking of that same
I
thing. He's,
love that. It's like,
yeah, he says what has been broken relationally must be repaired relationally. And
yes.
he talks about having to be sort of embodied, real.
Flawed, yes,
Yeah,
human,
exactly.
human, and I say this and I end this because I, when I was doing Jungian analysis, I went to various analysts trying to find a match, and the one that I eventually matched with was that way. It was not a container because I was an adult and I did not need that level of containment. I know people do sometimes. That was not what I was looking for. I needed someone who's also a writer, by the way, so it helped because I was working on my second novel,
Right,
who was
right.
flawed and real and was struggling with the same thing. And that's why I ended up feeling great love as well, because it
Yeah.
was that interchange that really was healing. The idea that someone was not only present to me, but was willing to be vulnerable to me. And
Yeah.
so I really appreciated him saying that because I've often heard from other therapists, well, you can't, you've got to sit there quiet. And it's like, well, I
Yeah,
don't
almost
know.
to be inhuman. Like, don't, I've heard that they train them, like, don't take a drink of water or don't wear jewelry or, you know, that is
It's like, no, I'm sorry. That's like, I'll
Yeah.
talk to ChatGPT. I mean, you want a level of human contact. And the human contact includes, I think, the parts of us that we don't want other people to see. Because what you're doing in that situation is also revealing parts of
Yeah.
yourself that are really vulnerable, right? Anyway,
Right.
I appreciate him totally. I will go now to the second book and follow it up because I think, I'll basically read anything he publishes. I just think he's
He's
fabulous.
fabulous. He's so
Yeah,
warm also to
as
listen.
well. As well. And I
Yeah.
will leave it here and I will also link it in the show notes. There is a great talk he gave that is at you on YouTube, which you can watch and listen to from Pacifica University. He gave it Pacifica, which is fabulous. And he talks a lot about this. And this is where he famously, and I'm gonna mangle it, but he says trauma is really an assault on the feeling capacity and what you're trying to bring back online is that. So I will link it because I hope more people do pick up his book. It is really, or books, they're fabulous. Anyway, thank you, Jenny. We'll resume our conversation next time with this.
Yeah, this was so fun, Bea. And I think it also does affirm that we, although there are aspects of our fate that we don't control, there are so many things that we do. We learn how to move around inside of a situation that we may not have chosen or that other people wouldn't choose off the shelf, and that all of the healing potential for Jung was, it was already here. It was
Yeah.
already there in the chart, and all of us have that.
That's a great way to end it. Fantastic. Thanks for listening. If you would like to support our podcast and you like what you're hearing, please go over to any of the places where you download it and leave a review. That helps other people find us. To find us personally, you can find me at sophiacycles.com and you can find Jenny Montgomery at jenny-montgomery.com. Links are all in the show notes. Until next time.